couldn't look anywhere on the dance floor without seeing someone who should have been making fun of people on the cover of magazines for being too ugly. Billy hadn't been as paranoid as me, and he stood staring at the dance floor, his eyes wide. I nudged him with my hip, hard enough to make his teeth clack together, and he jerked and gave me a guilty look. I forced my eyes away from the dancers, maybe 20 couples all told, to check out the rest of the ballroom. To one side of the room stood a bandstand, and the musicians on it all wore tuxes. They were mortals, human. They looked normal, which was to say almost deformed in comparison to the dancers they performed for. Both men and women played, and none of them looked well-rested or well-fed. Their tuxes were stained with sweat, and their hair hung lank and unwashed, and a closer look showed a silver manacle around the ankle of each of them, attached to a chain that ran through the bandstand, winding back and forth among them. They didn't look upset, though. Far from it. Every one of them was bent to the music, faces locked in intensity and concentration. And they were good, playing with a unity of tone and timing that you only see from bands who've really honed their art. That didn't change the fact that they were prisoners of the Fae, but they evidently had no particular problems with the notion. The music rattled the great stone room, shaking dust from the ceiling, hidden in the darkness overhead, while the she danced. Opposite the bandstand, the dance floor descended directly into a pool of water, or what I presumed was water, at any rate. It looked black and unnaturally still. Even as I watched, the waters stirred, moved by something out of sight beneath the surface. Color rolled and rippled over the dark surface, and I got the distinct impression that the pool wasn't water, or not just water. I fought down another shiver. Beyond the dance floor, on the side of the room opposite me, stood raised tiers of platforms, each one set with a separate little table, one that could sit three or four at the most, each one with its own dim green-shaded lamp. The tables all stood at different relative heights to one another, staggered back and forth until the tiers reached a pinnacle. A single chair, made out of what looked like silver, its flaring back carved into a sigil, a snowflake the size of a dinner table. The great chair stood empty. The drummer on the bandstand went into a brief solo, and the instruments cut off altogether, but for one. The other band members sagged into their seats, a couple of them simply collapsing onto the floor, but the lead trumpet stayed standing, belting out a solo while the Winter Lords danced. He was a middle-aged man, a little overweight, and his face flushed scarlet, then purple, as his trumpet rang out through the solo. Then, all at once, the she stopped dancing. Dozens of beautiful faces turned to watch the soloist, eyes glittering in the muted light. The man continued to play, but I could see that something was wrong. The flush of his face deepened even more, and veins began to throb in his forehead and throat. His eyes widened and began to bulge, and he started shaking. A moment later, the music began to falter. The man tore his face away from the trumpet, and I could see him gasping for breath. He couldn't get it. A second later, he jerked, then stiffened, and his eyes rolled up in his head. The trumpet slipped from his fingers, and he fell, first to his knees, then limply over to his side, to the floor of the bandstand. He hit it with finality, his eyes open but not focused. He twitched once more, and then his throat rattled, and he was still. A murmur went through the she, and I looked back to see them parting, stepping aside with deep bows and curtsies for someone emerging from their midst. A tall girl walked slowly toward the fallen musician. Her features were pale, radiant, perfect, and looked like an adolescent copy of Mab's. That was where the resemblance ended. She looked young. Young enough to make a man feel guilty for thinking the wrong thoughts, but old enough to make it difficult not to. Her hair had been bound into long dreadlocks, each of them dyed a different shade, ranging from a deep lavender to pale blues and greens to pure white, so that it almost seemed that her hair had been formed from glacial ice. She wore leather pants of dark, dark blue, laced and open up the outside seams from calf to hip. Her boots matched the pants. She wore a white T-shirt, tight enough to show the tips of her breasts, straining against the fabric, framing the words, "Off with his head." She had hacked the shirt off at the top of her ribcage, leaving pale flesh exposed, along with a glitter of silver flashing at her navel. She moved to the downed musician with a liquid grace, a thoughtless, casual sensuality that made a quiver of arousal slip down my spine. She settled down over him, throwing a leg over his hips, straddling him, and idly raked long, opalescent fingernails over his chest. He didn't move, didn't breathe. The girl licked her lips, her mouth spreading into a lazy smile, before she leaned down and kissed the corpse's dead lips. I saw her shiver with what was unmistakably pleasure. "There," she murmured. "There, you see? Never let it be said that the Lady Mav does not fulfill her promises. You said you'd die to play that well, poor creature, and now you have." A collective sigh went up from the assembled she, and then they began applauding enthusiastically. Mav looked back over her shoulder at them all, with a lifted chin and a lazy smile, before she stood up and bowed, left and right, to the sound of applause. The applause died off when Mav stalked away from the corpse and to the rising tiers of dinner seats, stepping lithely up them until she reached the great silver throne at the top. She dropped into it, turned sideways, and idly threw her legs over one arm, arching her back and stretching with the same lazy smile. "My lords and ladies, let us give our poor musical brutes a little time to recover their strength. We have a visitor." The she began drifting toward the tables on the tiers, stepping into place one by one. I stood where I was and said nothing, though as they settled down I became increasingly conscious of their attention, of the glittering intensity of immortal eyes upon me. Once they were all settled in, I stepped forward and walked across the dance floor until I stood at the foot of the tier. I looked up at Mav and inclined my head to her. "Lady Winter, I presume." Mav smiled at me, showing a dimple, and gave one foot a girlish bounce. "Indeed. You know in what capacity I am here, lady?"
"Naturally," I nodded. Nothing like a frontal assault, then. "Did you arrange the murder of the summer night?"
Silence fell on the room. The regard of the winter she grew more intent, more uncomfortable. Mav's mouth spread into a slow smile, which in turn became a quiet, rolling laugh. She let her head fall back with it, and the she joined in with her. They sat there laughing at me for a good 30 seconds, and I felt my face begin to heat up with irrational embarrassment before Mav waved one hand in a negligent gesture, and the laughter obediently died away.
"Stars," she murmured, "I adore mortals."
I clenched my jaw.
"That's swell," I said. "Did you arrange the murder of the summer night?"
"If I had, do you really think I would tell you?"
"You're evading," I growled. "Answer the question."
Mav lifted a fingertip to her lips as though she needed it to hold in more laughter. Then she smiled and said,
"I can't just give you that kind of information, Wizard Dresden. It's too powerful."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
She sat up, crossing her legs with a squeak of leather, and settled back on the throne.
"It means that if you want me to answer that question, you're going to have to pay for it. What is the answer worth to you?"
I folded my arms.
"I assume you have something in mind. That's why you sent someone to give us safe passage here."
"Quick," she murmured. "I like that. Yes, I do, wizard." She extended a hand to me and gestured to an open seat at the table to my right and a little beneath the level of her throne.
"Please sit down," she said, her teeth shone white. "Let's make a deal."
Chapter 15.
You want me to cut another deal with the she? I said. I didn't bother to hide my disbelief. When I burst out laughing at you, do you think you'll be offended?
And why should you find the notion amusing? I rolled my eyes.
Christ, lady, that's what got me into this crap to begin with.
Mauve's lips slithered into a quiet smile, and her left hand extended toward the seat beside her.
Remember, wizard, that you came seeking something from me. Surely it would not harm you to listen to my offer.
I've heard that before, usually right before I get screwed. Mav touched the tip of her tongue to her lips.
One thing at a time, Mr. Dresden, I snorted. Suppose I don't want to listen.
Something in her eyes suddenly made her face cold and unpleasant.
I think it might be wise for you to indulge me. I simply go mad when someone ruins a good party mood.
Harry, Billy muttered, these people are giving me the creeps. If she's playing games with you, maybe we should go.
I grimaced.
Yeah, that would be the smart thing, but it wouldn't get me any answers. Come on.
I stepped forward and started climbing up to the table Mav had indicated. Billy followed closely. Mav watched me the whole time, her eyes sparkling.
There, she said, once I'd been seated. Not so untamable as he claimed.
I felt my jaw get a little tighter as Billy took a seat beside me. A trio of brightly colored lights zipped in, bearing a silver tray holding a crystalline ewer of water and two glasses.
As who said? Mav waved a hand airily.
No matter.
I glared at her, but she didn't seem bothered. All right, lady, I said. Talk.
Mav idly stretched out a hand. A goblet of some golden liquid appeared in her fingers and rimmed over with frost as I watched. She took a sip of the drink, whatever it was, and said,
First, I will name my price.
There'd better be a blue light special. I don't have much to trade, all things considered.
True. I cannot ask for a claim over you, because Queen Mab has that already. But let me see.
She tapped a fingernail to her lips again and then said,
Your issue.
Huh? I said, glibly.
Your issue, wizard, she said, toying with a violet dreadlock. Your offspring. Your firstborn. In exchange, I will give you the knowledge you seek.
Newsflash, Coldilocks. I don't have any children.
Mav laughed.
Naturally not. But the details could be arranged.
Evidently, that was a cue. The dark pool of maybe water stirred, drawing my eye. Ripples whispered as they lapped at the edges of the pool.
What's that? Billy whispered to me. The waters parted, and a she-girl rose out of the pool. She was tall, slender, water sliding down over pale, naked, supple curves. Her hair was a deep shade of emerald green, and as she kept on coming up out of the water, walking up what were apparently submerged stairs, I could tell it wasn't dyed. Her face was sweetly angelic, sort of girl-next-door pretty. Her hair clung to her head, her throat, her shoulders, as did beads of water that glistened and threw back the fey lights in dozens of colors. She extended her arms, and immediately half a dozen little lights, pixies, zipped out of nowhere, bearing a swath of emerald silk. They draped it over her extended arms, but the cloth served to emphasize, rather than conceal, her nakedness. She looked up at the tables with her feline fey eyes and inclined her head to Mav. Then she focused on me. There was an abrupt pulling sensation, something as simple and as difficult to resist as gravity. I felt a sudden urge to get up and go down to her, to remove the silk cloth and to carry her into the water. I wanted to see her hair fan out beneath the surface, feel her naked limbs sliding around me. I wanted to feel that slender waist beneath my hands, twist and writhe with her in the warm, weightless darkness of the pool. Beside me, Billy gulped.
Is it just me, or is it getting a little warm in here?
She's pushing it on you, I said quietly. My lips felt a little numb.
It's glamour. It isn't real.
Okay, Billy said without conviction. It isn't real. He reached for a glass and the ewer of water, but I grabbed his hand.
No, food. No drink. It's dangerous.
Billy cleared his throat and settled back into his seat.
Oh, right, sorry.
The girl glided up the tiers of tables, glittering pixies and darting attendants around her, gathering her hair back with ornate combs, fastening gleaming jewels to her ears, lacing more about her throat, wrist, ankle. I couldn't help but follow the motion of the lights, which took my eyes on a thorough tour of her body. The urge to go to her became even stronger as she neared. I smelled her perfume, a scent like that of the mist hovering over a still lake beneath the harvest moon. The green-haired woman smiled, lips closed, then drew up in a deep curtsy to Mav and murmured,
"My lady."
Mav reached out and took her hand warmly.
"Jen," she murmured, "are you acquainted with the infamous Harry Dresden?"
Jen smiled, and her teeth gleamed between her lips. They were as green as seaweed, spinach, and fresh-steamed broccoli.
"Only by reputation."
She turned to me and extended her hand, arching one verdant brow. I gave Billy a self-conscious glance and rose to take the she-lady's hand. I nudged Billy's foot with mine, and he stood up, too. I bowed politely over Jen's hand. Her fingers were cool, damp. I got the impression that her flawless skin should have been prune-wrinkled, but it wasn't. I had to fight the urge to kiss the back of her hand, to taste her cool flesh. I managed to keep a neutral tone to my voice and said, "Good evening." The she-lady smiled at me, showing her green teeth again, and said,
"Something of a gentleman. I wouldn't have expected it."
She withdrew her hand and said, "And tall." Her eyes roamed over me in idle speculation. "I like tall men." I felt my cheeks flush and grow warmer. Other parts suffered from similar inflammation. Mav asked, "Is she lovely enough to suit you, wizard? You've no idea how many mortal men have longed for her, and how few have known her embrace." Jen let out a quiet laugh. "For more than about 3 minutes, at any rate." Mav drew Jen down until the nearly nude she-lady knelt beside the throne. Mav toyed with a strand of her curling leaf-green hair with one hand.
"Why not agree to my offer, wizard? Spend a night in the company of my maiden. Is it not a pleasant price?"
My voice came out more quietly than I intended.
"You want me to get a child on her. A child you would keep."
Mav's eyes glittered. She leaned toward me and said very quietly,
"Do not let that concern you. I can feel your hunger, mortal man. The needs in you, hot as a fever. Let go for a time. No mortal could sate you as she will." I felt my eyes drawn to the she-woman, trailing down the length of pale flesh left bare between the idle drapes of emerald silk, following the length of her legs. That hunger rose again in me, a raw and unthinking need. Scent flooded over me, a perfume of wind and mist, of heated flesh. Scent evoked more phantom sensations of silken caresses of delicate fey hands, sweetly hot rake of nails, winding strength of limbs tangled with mine. Mav's eyes brightened.
"Perhaps she is not enough for you. Perhaps you would wish another, even myself."
As I watched, Jen leaned her cheek against Mav's thigh and placed a soft kiss upon the tight leather. Mav shifted, a slow, sensual motion of her hips and back, and murmured,
"Or more, if your thirst runs deep enough. Drive a hard bargain, wizard. All of us would enjoy that."
The longing, an aching force of naked need, redoubled. The two fairies were lovely, more than lovely, sensuous, willing, perfectly unrestrained, perfectly passionate. I could feel that in them, radiating from them. If I made the bargain, they would make the evening one of nothing but indulgence, sensation, satiation, delight. Mav and her handmaiden would do things to me that you only read about in magazines.
"Dear penthouse," I muttered, "I never thought something like this would happen to me."
"Wizard," Mav murmured.
I see you weighing the consequences in your eyes. You think too much. It weakens you. Stop thinking. Come down to earth with us. Some mathematical and uncaring part of my brain, way the hell in the back of my head, reminded me that I did need that information. A simple statement from Mav would tell me if she was the killer or not. Go ahead, it told me. It isn't as though it's going to be painful for you to pay her price. Don't you deserve to have something pleasant happen to you for a change? Make the bargain. Get the information. Get wasted on kisses and pleasure and soft skin. Live a little before that borrowed time you're on runs out. I reached out with a shaking hand to the crystal ewer on the table. I clenched it. It clinked and rattled against the glass as I poured cool, sparkling water into it. Mab's smile grew sharper.
Harry, Billy said, his voice uncertain. Didn't you just say something bad about, you know, taking food or drink from from these people?
I put the pitcher down and picked up the glass of water. Jen rubbed her cheek against Mav's thigh and murmured, "They never really change, do they?"
"No," Mav said. "The males all fall to the same thing. Isn't it delicious?"
I unbuttoned the fly in my jeans, undid the zipper a little, and dumped the cold water directly down my pants. Some shocks of sensation are pleasant. This one wasn't. The water was so cold that tiny chips of ice had formed in it, as though it was trying to freeze itself from the inside out. That cold went right down where I had intended it to go, and everything in my jeans tried to contract into my abdomen in sheer hypothermic horror. I let out a little yelp, and my skin promptly crawled with goose flesh. The gesture had its intended effect. That overwhelming, almost feral hunger withered and vanished. I was able to take my eyes off the Winter Lady and her handmaiden to clear my thoughts into something resembling a sane line of reason. I shook my head a bit to be sure, and then looked up at Mab. Anger surged through me, and my jaw clenched tight, but I made an effort to keep my words at least marginally polite.
"Sorry, sweetie, but I have a couple of problems with that offer."
Mav's lips tightened. "And those would be?"
"One, I'm not handing over a child to you. Not mine, not anyone's, not now, and not ever. If you had a brain in your head, you'd have known that."
Mav's already pale face blanched even more, and she sat bolt upright on her throne.
"You dare?
Shut up!" I snarled, and it came loud enough to ring off the walls of the ballroom. "I'm not finished." Mav jerked as though I'd slapped her. Her mouth dropped open, and she blinked at me. "I came here under your invitation and protection. I am your guest. But in spite of that, you've thrown glamour at me anyway." I stood up, my hands spread on the table, leaning toward her for emphasis. "I don't have time for this crap." "You don't scare me, lady," I said. "I only came here for answers. If you keep pushing me, I'm going to push back. Hard."
Mav's evident anger evaporated. She leaned back on her throne, her lips pursed, her expression placid and enigmatic.
"Well, well, well. Not so easily captured, it would seem."
A new voice, a relaxed, masculine drawl, slid into the silence.
"I told you, Mav. You should have been polite. Anyone who declares war on the Red Court isn't going to be the sort to take kindly to pressure."
The speaker stepped into the ballroom through the double doors and walked casually to the banquet tables and toward Mav's throne. It was a man, maybe in his early 30s, medium build, maybe half an inch shy of 6 feet tall. He wore dark jeans, a white tee, and a leather jacket. Droplets of dark reddish-brown stained his shirt and one side of his face. His scalp was bald, but for the stubble of dark hair. As he approached, I picked out more details. He had a brand on his throat. A snowflake made of white scar tissue stood out sharply against his skin. The skin on one side of his face was red and a little swollen, and he was missing half of an eyebrow and a crescent of stubble on his scalp on the side. He'd been burned. And recently,
He reached the throne and dropped to one knee before it, somehow conveying a certain relaxed insolence with the gesture, and extended the box to Mav.
"It is done?" Mav asked, an almost childlike eagerness to her voice. "What took you so long?"
"It wasn't easy as you said it would be, but I did it."
The Winter Lady all but snatched the carved box from his hands, avarice lighting in her eyes.
"Wizard, this is my knight, Lloyd of the family Slate."
Slate nodded to me.
"How are you?"
"Impatient," I responded, but I nodded back to him warily. "You're the Winter Knight?"
"So far, yeah. I guess you're the Winter Emissary, asking questions and investigating and so on."
"Yep. Did you kill Ronald Rule?" Slate burst out laughing.
"Christ, Dresden, you don't waste time, do you?"
"I've filled my insincere courtesy quota for the day," I said. "Did you kill him?"
Slate shrugged and said, "No. To be honest with you, I'm not sure I could have killed him. He's been at this a lot longer than me."
"He was an old man," I said. "So were a lot of wizards," Slate pointed out.
"I could have bench-pressed him. Sure. Killing him is something else altogether."
Mav let out a sudden hiss of anger, the sound eerily loud. She lifted her foot and kicked Slade in the shoulder. Something popped when she did, and the force of the kick drove the Winter Knight down a tier into the table and the she seated there. The table toppled, and she, chairs, and knight went sprawling. Mav rose to her feet, sending the green-toothed Jen scooting away from her. She drew what looked like a military-issue combat knife from the carved box. It was crusted with some kind of black gelatinous substance, like burned barbecue sauce.
"You stupid animal," she snarled. "Useless. This is useless to me."
She hurled the knife at Slate. The handle hit him in the biceps of his left arm just as he sat up again. His face twisted into sudden fury. He took up the knife, rose to his feet, and stalked toward Mav with murder in his eye. Mav drew herself up, her face shining with a sudden, terrible beauty. She lifted her right hand, ring finger and thumb both bent, and murmured something in a liquid, alien tongue. Sudden blue light gathered around her fingers, and the temperature in the room dropped by about 40 degrees. She spoke again and flicked her wrist, sending glowing motes of azure flickering toward Slate. The snowflake brand flared into sudden light, and Slate's advance halted, his body going rigid. The skin around the brand turned blue, then purple, then black, spreading like a stop-motion enhanced film of gangrene. A quiet snarl slipped from Slate's lips, and I could see his body trembling with the effort to continue toward Mav. He shuddered and took another step forward. Mav lifted her other hand, her index finger extended, while the others curled, and a sudden wind whipped past me, cold enough that it stole the breath from my lungs. The wind whipped madly around Slate, making his leather coat flap. Bits of white frost started forming on his eyelashes and eyebrows. His expression, now anguished as well as full of rage, faltered, and his advance halted again.
"Calm him," Mav murmured.
Jen slipped behind Slate, wrapping her arms around his neck, leaning her mouth down close to his ear. Slate's eyes flickered with hot, violent hate for a moment, and then began to grow heavier. Jen ran her hand slowly down the sleeve of his jacket, fingers caressing his wrist. His arm lowered as I watched. A moment later, Jen slid the jacket from his shoulders. The tee was sleeveless, and Slate's arms were hard with muscle, and tracked with needle marks. Jen slid out a hand, and another darting pixie handed her a hypodermic needle. Jen slipped it into the bend of his arm, still whispering to him, sliding the plunger down. Slate's eyes rolled back in his head, and he sank to his knees. Jen went down with him, wrapping around him like kelp on a swimmer, her mouth next to his ear. Mav lowered her hands, and the wind and the cold died away. She lifted a shaking hand to her face and stepped back to the throne, settling stiffly into it, narrowed eyes locked on Slate's increasingly malleable form. Her cheekbones stood out more sharply than before. Her eyes looked more sunken. She gripped the arms of the throne, her fingers twitching.
"What the hell was that?" Billy whispered. "Probably what passes for a polite disagreement," I muttered. "Get up. We're leaving."
I stood up,
Mav's eyes darted to me. Her voice came out dry, harsh. Our bargain is not yet complete, wizard.
This talk is.
But I have not answered your question.
Keep your answer. I don't need it anymore.
You don't?
Mav asked.
We don't, Billy said.
I nodded towards Slate and Jen. You had to push yourself to make him stand still. Look at you. You're just about out of gas right now from going up against your own knight.
I started down the tiers, Billy coming with me.
Besides that, you're sloppy, sweetheart. Reckless. A clean killing like rules takes a plan, and that isn't you.
I could feel her eyes pressing against my back like frozen thorns. I ignored her.
I did not give you leave to go, wizard, she said, her voice chilly. I didn't ask.
I won't forget this insolence.
I probably will, I said. It's nothing special. Come on, Billy.
I walked to the double doors and out. As soon as we were outside, the doors swung shut with a huge, hollow boom that made us jump. Darkness fell, sudden and complete, and I fumbled for my amulet as my heart lurched in panic. The spectral light from my amulet showed me Billy's strained face first, and then the area immediately around us. The double doors were gone. Only a blank stone wall remained where they had been.
Gulp, Billy said.
He shook his head for a moment, dazed.
Where did they go?
I rested my fingers against the stone wall, reaching out for it with my wizard senses.
Nothing. It was rock, not illusion.
Beats the hell out of me. The doors here must have been away to some other location.
Like some kind of teleport?
More like a temporary entrance into the Never-Never, I said, or a shortcut through the Never-Never to another place on Earth.
Kind of intense in there, when she made it get all cold. Never seen anything like that before.
Sloppy, I said. She was laying a binding on Slate. Her power was sloshing over into changing the temperature. A child could do it better.
Billy let out a short, quiet laugh. After what we just saw, anyone else would still be shaking. You're giving her the rating from the Russian judge.
So sue me, I shrugged. She's strong. Strong isn't everything.
Billy glanced up at me. Could you do what she did?
I'd probably use fire.
His eyebrows went up, his expression impressed. Do you really think Mav's not the killer?
I do, I said. This murder was clean enough to look like an accident. Mav's obviously got impulse control issues. Doesn't make for much of a methodical murderer.
And what about Slate?
I shook my head, my brow tightening.
I'm not sure about him. He's mortal. There's nothing that says he couldn't lie to us. But I got what I was looking for, and I found out a couple of things on top of that.
So why are you frowning?
Because all I got is more questions. Everyone's been telling me to hurry. Fairies don't do that. They're practically immortal, and they're not in a rush. But Mav and Grey Malkin both have tried to rush me now. Mav went for the high-pressure sales tactic, too, like she didn't have time for anything more subtle.
Why would they do that?
I sighed.
Something's in motion.
If I don't run down the killer, the courts could go to war with one another.
That would explain the whole World War II dress motif back there.
Yeah, but not why time would be so pressing. I shook my head. If we could have stayed there longer, I might have been able to work out more, but it was getting too nervous in there.
Discretion, valor, Billy said by way of agreement. We leave now, right?
Elodie, I asked. I felt a stirring in my hair, and then the tiny pixie popped out to hover in the air in front of me. Can you lead us back to my car? The pixie flashed in the affirmative and zipped away. I lifted my amulet and followed. Billy and I didn't speak until our guide led us out of the underground complex not far from where we parked the Blue Beetle. We cut through an alley. About halfway down it, Billy grabbed my arm and jerked me bodily behind him, snapping, "Harry, get back!" In the same motion, he swung out one foot and kicked a metal trash can. It went flying, crashing into something I hadn't seen behind it. Someone let out a short, harsh gasp of pain. Billy stepped forward and picked up the metal lid that had fallen to the ground. He swung it down at the shape. It struck with a noisy crash. I took a couple steps back to make sure I was clear of the action and reached for my amulet again.
Billy, I said, what the hell?
I felt the sudden presence at my back half a second too late to get out of the way. A hand the size of a dinner plate closed on the back of my neck like a vice and lifted.
I felt my heels rise until my toes were just barely touching the ground. A voice, a feminine contralto, growled, "Let go of the amulet and call him off, wizard. Call him off before I break your neck."
Chapter 16. Being held up by your neck hurts. Trust me on this one. I lifted my hands by way of attempting to convey compliance and said, "Billy, get off him."
Billy took a step back from the pale-haired young man he'd knocked down. Fix whimpered and scuttled away on his hands and butt. His borrowed brown suit was soiled and torn, and his yellow polyester tie hung from his collar by only one of its clips. He put his back against the alley wall, eyes wide beneath a shock of white dandelion hair. Billy's eyes flickered from my assailant to Fix and back. He squinted at her for a moment, then set his jaw in an expression of casual determination.
"Harry, you want me to take her?"
"Wait a minute," I managed to say.
"Okay, he's off. Put me down."
The grip on the back of my neck relaxed, and as I touched ground again, I took a step toward Billy, turning to face the woman who had held me. As I expected, it was the tall, muscular young woman from the funeral home, her muddy green hair hanging lankly over her eyes and one cheek. She folded her arms and shifted her weight from one foot to the other.
"Fix, are you okay?"
The smaller man panted.
"My lip is cut. It isn't bad."
The woman nodded and faced me again.
"All right," I said. "Who the hell are you?"
"My name is Merrill," she said. Her voice was surprisingly quiet, contrasting with her size. "I wanted to apologize, Mr. Dresden, for hitting you and throwing you into the dumpster."
I raised my eyebrows. "Are you sure you got the right guy, Merrill? No one ever apologizes to me for anything."
She pushed at her hair with one hand. It felt right back over her face.
"I'm sorry. I was scared earlier, and I acted without thinking."
I traded a glance with Billy.
Okay. I'm pretty sure lurking in a dark alley to mug me with your apology isn't the usual way to go about saying you're sorry. But I didn't read that Mars-Venus book, so who knows?"
Her mouth twitched, and she relaxed her stance by a tiny degree.
"I didn't know how else to find you, so I was just waiting near your car."
"Okay," I said. My neck still throbbed where her fingers had clamped on. 5-1, I would have some wonderful stripy bruises the next day. I nodded and turned away.
"Apology accepted. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have things I need to do."
A note of panic crept into her voice.
"Wait, please."
I stopped and looked back at her.
"I need to talk to you, just for a minute."
She took a deep breath.
"I need your help."
Of course she did.
"It's very important."
Of course it was. My headache started coming back.
"Look, Merrill, I've got a lot on my plate already."
"I know," she said. "Investigating Ron's death. I think I can help you." I pursed my lips. "You were close to Rule?" She nodded.
"Me, Fix, Ace, and Lily."
I flashed back on the photo of Rule and the four young people. "Green-haired girl? Very cute?"
"Yes."
"Where's Ace?"
"He had to go to work right after the funeral, but Lily's why I need to talk to you. She's missing. I think she's in trouble."
I started filling in context on the conversation I'd overheard between them.
"Who are you?"
"I told you. My name is Merrill."
"Okay, fine. What are you, Merrill?"
She flinched at the question.
"Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know what you meant."
She raked at her hair again.
"I'm a changeling. We all are."
"A what?" Billy asked. I nodded, getting it.
"Changeling," I said to Billy. "She's half mortal, half fey."
"Aha," Billy said.
"Which means what?"
I shrugged.
"It means that she has to choose whether to remain immortal or become wholly fey." "Yes," she said. "And until then, I'm under the rule of the court of my fey father, Winter. The others, too. That's why the four of us stick together. It was safer."
Billy nodded.
"Oh." "Merrill," I said, "what makes you think your friend is in trouble?"
"She's not very independent, Mr. Dresden. We share an apartment. She doesn't have a very good idea of how to take care of herself, and she gets nervous if she's out of the apartment for too long."
"And what do you think happened to her?"
"The winter night."
Billy frowned.
"Why would he hurt people of his own court?" Merrill let out a brief, hard laugh. Because he can? He had a thing for Lily. He would hurt her, frighten her. He got off on it. He was furious when Mav told him to back off. And once Ron was gone, her voice trailed off and she turned her head to one side. How does Rule fit into this? I asked. He was protecting us. Mav had been torturing us for fun and we didn't know where to turn. Ron took us in. He put us under his protection, and no one in Winter was willing to cross him.
And what about your fey dad? Billy asked. Didn't he do anything to look out for you?
Merrill gave Billy a flat look. My mother was raped by a troll. Even if he'd been strong enough to do anything about Mav hurting us, he wouldn't have. He thinks he's already done enough by not devouring my mom on the spot.
Oh, Billy said. Sorry.
I frowned. And with the summer night gone, you think Slate grabbed the girl? Merrill said. Someone broke into the apartment. Looked like there'd been a struggle. I let out a sigh. Have you contacted the police? Oh, yeah, of course. I called them and told them that a mortal champion of the Fae came and spirited away a half-mortal, half-Nixie professional nude model from Fairyland.
I had to admire the well-placed sarcasm.
It doesn't take a supernatural stud muffin to cause something very bad to happen to a cute girl in this town. Your plain old mortal kidnappers and murderers can manage just fine. She shook her head. Either way, she's still in trouble. I lifted a hand. What do you want from me?
Help me find her, please, Mr. Dresden.
I closed my eyes. I didn't have time, energy, or brain power to spare for this. The smart thing would be to blow her off entirely, or promise her I'd do it and promptly forget about it. This just isn't a good time. I felt like crap the second I said it. I didn't look at the changeling's face. I couldn't. There's too much trouble already, and I don't even know if I can help myself, much less your friend. I'm sorry. I turned to go, but Merrill stepped in front of me. Wait. I told you, I said. There's nothing I can... I'll pay you, Merrill said. Oh, right. Money. I was about to lose the office and the apartment, and this fairy work only paid in misery. I needed to pay some bills, go to the grocery store. My mouth didn't actually water, but it was close. I shook my head again. Look, Merrill, I wish I could.
Double your fee, she said, her voice urgent.
Double my fee? I hesitated some more. Triple, she said. She reached out for her back pocket and produced an envelope.
Plus 1,000 cash, up front, right now.
I looked back at Fix, still trembling and leaning against the alley wall, a handkerchief pressed to his mouth. Merrill continued to rock from one foot to the other, her eyes on the ground, waiting. I tried to look at things objectively. $1,000 wouldn't spend if I got myself killed while distracted by the additional workload. On the other hand, if I lived through this thing, the money would be necessary. My stomach growled, and a sharp pang of hunger made me clench the muscles of my belly. I needed the work. But more to the point, I needed to be able to live with myself. I wasn't sure I was comfortable with the idea of looking back on this particular patch of memory and seeing myself leave some helpless girl, changeling or not, to the metaphoric wolves. People don't ask me for help if they're anything less than desperate. The changelings had been terrified of me a few hours before. If they turned to me for help now, it was because they were out of options. And they also had money. Damn it, damn it, damn it, I muttered. I snatched the envelope. All right. I'll look into it. I'll do what I can. But I can't make you any promises. Merrill let out a shuddering breath.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Dresden.
Yeah, I sighed. I reached into my pocket and pulled out a slightly crumpled business card. Here's my office number. Call and leave a message to let me know how I can reach you. She took the card and nodded.
I don't know if I can pay your fees all at once, but I'll be good for it, even if it takes a while.
Well, we can worry about that later when we're all safe and sound, I said, and I nodded to her, then to Fix, and started walking down the alley again. Billy kept an eye on the pair of them and followed me. We reached the parking lot of the funeral home a few minutes later. The lights were all out, and the Blue Beetle was the only car left in the lot. No one had bothered to steal it. What a shock.
So what's next? Billy asked.
I'll call Murphy, see if she can tell me about Lloyd Slate. Billy nodded.
Anything I can do to help?
Actually, yeah, I said. Get out the phone book and call the hospitals. See if the morgues have a green-haired Jane Doe.
You think she's dead, then?
I think it would be a lot simpler if she was.
He grimaced.
Calling morgues? There must be about a million of them in Chicagoland. Isn't there anything else I could do?
Well, welcome to the glamorous world of private investigation. You want to help or not?
Okay, Billy said. My car's a block over. I'll get back to you as soon as I'm done making calls.
All right, I'll probably be at my place, but if not, you know the drill.
Billy nodded.
Be careful. And he walked quickly down the street without looking back. I fumbled my keys out and walked to the Beetle. I didn't smell the blood until I was close enough to touch the car. Through the window, I saw a form, more or less human-shaped, curled up on my passenger seat. I circled cautiously to the other side of the car, then abruptly opened the door.
Elaine fell out of the car onto the pavement of the parking lot. She was drenched in blood that had soaked through her T-shirt, matted her golden brown hair on one side, and ran down her flanks to saturate her jeans to mid-thigh. Her silver pinnacle shone with liquid scarlet. The skin of her forearms was covered with long slashes and blood, and her face looked white. Dead. My heart hammered in my chest, and I leaned down to her, fumbling at her throat. She still had a very slow pulse, but her skin felt cool and waxy. She started shuddering and whispered,
"Harry."
I'm here, Elaine.
"Please," she whispered. "Oh, God, please help me."
Chapter 17. I laid Elaine out, first thing, and tried to determine the extent of her injuries. Her forearms had been laced open in several places, but the worst injury was on her back, just inside her left clavicle, a nasty puncture wound. The edges of it had puckered closed, but it hadn't stopped the bleeding completely, and if she was bleeding internally, she could be done for. I would need both hands to put pressure on the wound. No help was on the way. There was little I could do for her, so I picked her up and put her into the Beetle, then jumped in myself and started the ignition.
"Hang in there, Elaine," I said. "I'm getting you to the hospital. You're going to be all right."
She shook her head.
No, too dangerous."
"You're hurt too badly for me to take care of it," I said. "Relax, I'll be with you." She opened her eyes with a sudden, surprising insistence.
"No hospitals. They'll find me there."
I started up the car.
"Damn it, Elaine, what else am I supposed to do?"
She closed her eyes again. Her voice grew fainter by the word.
"Aurora, Summer, Rothschild Hotel. There's a elevator in the back. She'll help."
"The Summer lady?" I demanded. "You're joking, right?" She didn't answer me. I looked over at her and my heart all but stopped as I saw her head lolling, her body slumped, and I jammed the Beetle into gear and jounced out onto the road.
"Rothschild Motel," I muttered. "More fairies. Keen."
I got us to the hotel, one of the nice places along the shores of Lake Michigan. I skipped the huge valet-littered front drive and zipped the Beetle into the back parking lot, looking for some kind of service entrance or freight elevator, or maybe just a sign with a door on it that said, "Summer Court of the Fairies This Way." I felt a slight warmth on my ear, and then Elodie zoomed out in front of my face and bumped up against the window. I rolled the window down a bit, and the tiny fairy streaked out ahead of my car, guiding me to the back of the lot. She stopped, circling in an unobtrusive, unlit breezeway. Then she sped away, her task evidently completed. I quickly parked the car and set the brake. Elaine may have been slender, but she had too much muscle to be light. She'd always had the build of a long-distance runner, long and lean and strong. She was only just conscious enough to make it a little easier for me to carry her, wrapping her arms around my neck and leaning her head on my shoulder. She trembled and felt cold. Doubt gnawed at me as I took her down the breezeway. Maybe I should have ignored her and gone to the hospital. I kept going until it became too dark to see, and I started to put Elaine down so that I could take out my amulet to make some light. Just as I did, a pair of elevator doors swept open, spilling light and canned music onto the breezeway. A girl stood in the doors. She was 5 feet nothing, 100 and nothing, her sunny hair pulled back into a braid.
She wore a blue T-shirt with white painter's overalls, and she was liberally splattered with flecks of what looked like clay. Her rosy mouth opened in dismay as she saw me standing there with Elaine.
"Oh, no," she exclaimed. She beckoned me urgently. "Come on, get her inside. The lady can see to her."
My arms and shoulders had begun to burn with the effort of supporting Elaine, so I didn't waste time talking. I shuffled forward into the elevator and leaned against the back wall with a wheeze. The girl closed the elevator doors, took a key from her overalls pocket, and inserted it into a solitary keyhole where you would expect a bunch of buttons to be. The elevator gave a little lurch and started up.
"What happened to Ella?"
the girl asked me. She looked from me to Elaine and chewed on one lip.
"Ella?"
"Beats me. I found her like this in my car. She told me to bring her here."
Oh, God," the girl said. She looked at me again. "You're with Winter, aren't you?"
I frowned.
"How did you know?"
She shrugged.
"It shows."
"I'm with Winter for now, but it's a one-shot deal. Think of me as a free agent."
"Perhaps, but an agent of Winter, all the same. Are you sure you want to be here?"
"No," I said, "but I'm sure I'm not leaving Elaine until I'm convinced she's in good hands." The girl frowned.
"Oh.
Can't this thing go any faster?"
My shoulders burned, my back ached, my bruises were complaining, and I could feel Elaine's breathing growing weaker. I had to fight not to scream in sheer frustration. I wished there had been a bank of buttons to push, just so that I could have slammed the right button a bunch of times in a senseless effort to speed up the elevator. The doors opened a geological epoch later, onto a scene as incongruous as a gorilla in a garter belt. The elevator had taken us to what could only have been the roof of the hotel, assuming the roof opened onto a section of rainforest in Borneo. Trees and greenery grew so thick that I couldn't see the edge of the roof, and though I could hear the nighttime noises of Chicago, the sounds were vague in the distance and could almost not be heard over the buzz of locusts and the chittering of some kind of animal I did not recognize. Wind rustled the forest around me, and silver moonlight, brighter than I would have thought possible, gave everything an eerie, surreal beauty.
"I'm so glad I was going out for more clay just then. This way," the girl said, and started off on a trail through the forest.
I followed as quickly as I could, puffing hard to keep holding Elaine. It wasn't a long walk. The trail wound back and forth and then opened onto a grassy glade. I stopped and looked around. No, not a glade. More like a garden. A pool rested at its center, still water reflecting the moon overhead. Benches and stones of a good size for sitting on were strewn around the landscape. Statuary, most of it marble and of human subjects, stood here and there, often framed by flowers or placed between young trees. On the far side of the pool stood what at first glance I took to be a gnarled tree. It wasn't. It was a throne. A throne of living wood. Its trunk grown into the correct shape, branches and leaves spreading above it in stately elegance, roots spreading and anchoring it in the earth. People stood here and there. A paint-spattered young man worked furiously on some sort of portrait, his face set in concentration. A tall man, his ageless beauty and pale hair marked him as one of the she, stood in a posture of a teacher beside a slender girl, who was drawing back a bow, aiming at a target of bundled branches. On the far side of the glade, smoke rose from stones piled into the shape of an oven or a forge, and a broad-chested man, shirtless, bearded, heavy-browed, and fierce-looking, stood on the other side of it, wielding a smith's hammer in regular rhythm. He stepped away from the forge, a glowing hot blade gripped in a set of tongs, and dunked it into a trough of silvery water. When I got a better look at him, I understood what he was. Steam rose in a cloud over his heavy equine forelegs, then over his human belly and broad chest, and the centaur stamped a rear hoof impatiently, muttering under his breath, while colored lights played back and forth in the water of the trough. Haunting pipe music, sad and lovely, drifted through the glade from a young woman, mortal, sitting with a set of reed pipes, playing with her eyes closed.
"Where is she?" I demanded. "Where is the lady?"
The centaur's head snapped around, and he snarled in a sudden harsh basso. He took up his hammer again, whipped it in a quick circle, and started toward me at a slow canter. Clydesdale sighed, hoofs striking the ground with dull thumps.
Winterbound? Here? It cannot be borne!
I tensed, holding Elaine a little closer, and my heart lurched into a higher gear. The centaur was huge and looked ready to kill.
Whoa there, big fella, I'm not looking for trouble.
The centaur bared his teeth at me and spoke, his deep voice filled with outrage.
There you stand with your emissary's blood on your hands and expect us to believe you?
The tall she-man barked.
Korik, hold.
The centaur drew up short, rearing onto its hind legs and kicking at the air with heavy hooves.
My lord Talos, he growled in frustration, this arrogance cannot be tolerated.
Peace, the she-lord said.
But my lord!
The she-lord stepped between me and the centaur, his back to me. He wore close-fit trousers of dark green and a loose shirt of white linen. The she-lord said nothing, and I couldn't see his expression, but the centaur's face reddened, then blanched. He bowed his head, a stiff gesture, then walked back over to his forge, hooves striking the ground in sharp, angry motions. The she, Talos, I presumed, turned back to me and regarded me with calm, feline eyes the color of a summer sky. He had the pale hair of the she, hanging in a straight, fine sheet to brush his shoulders. There was a quality of quiet confidence in his features, of relaxed strength, and the sense of him was somehow less alien than that of most of the she I'd encountered.
I hope you will not judge Korik too harshly, sir. You are, I take it, Harry Dresden. If I'm not, he's going to be upset with me when he catches me running around in his underpants.
Talos smiled. The expression came easily to his features. Then I grant you passport and license in agreement with the Accords. I am Talos, Lord Marshal of the Summer Court.
Yeah, that's great. Nice to meet you, I said. Hey, do you think you could help me save this woman's life now?
The she's smile faded.
I will do what I can.
He glanced to the side and gestured with a roll of his wrist. The garden flew into activity. A cloud of pixies darted through the air, bearing stalks of green plants and broad, soft leaves. They piled them into a soft-looking mound near the side of the pool. Talos looked at me for permission and then gently took Elaine's weight into his arms. My shoulders and biceps all but screamed in relief. The she-lord carried Elaine to the bed of leaves and laid her down upon it. He touched her throat and then her brow with one hand, his eyes closing.
Weak, he said quietly, and cold. But she has strength left in her. She will be all right for a little while.
No offense, but your people have some odd notions about time. Go and get your lady. She needs to see Elaine now.
Talos regarded me with that same quiet, opaque expression.
She will be here when she will be here. I cannot hurry the sunrise, nor the lady.
I started to tell him where he could stick his sunrise, but I bit back the words and tried to take out some frustration by clenching my fists. My knuckles popped. A hand touched my arm, and the girl, the sculptor from the elevator, said,
"Please, sir, let me get you something to drink, or some food. Mortal food, I mean. I wouldn't offer you the other kind."
"Like hell," I said. "Not until Elaine is taken care of." From where he knelt beside Elaine, Talos lifted both eyebrows, but he shrugged his shoulders.
"As you wish."
He rested his fingertips lightly on either side of her face and bowed his head.
"My skills are rather limited, but I can assure you that she loses no ground."
There was a quiet surge of energy, something as gentle and strong as the weight of a wave lifting you off your feet. Elaine suddenly took a deep breath, and color came back into her cheeks. She blinked her eyes open for a moment, then sighed and closed them again.
"Talos can sustain her for a time," the girl said, "until the lady decides. He has been Ella's guardian and friend for several years."
She tugged at my arm.
"Please, take something to eat. You'll make us poor hosts if you don't."
My stomach growled again, and my throat started to complain after all the hard breathing I've been doing. I exhaled through my nose and nodded to the girl, who led me to one of the benches not far away, and pulled a plastic Coleman cooler from underneath it. She rummaged inside, then tossed me a cold can of Coke, and a small bag of potato chips, and a long hoagie. None of them held any of the subtle quivering lure of